Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Late last week, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin told the Associated Press that he had completed a six-month investigation and determined that Comcast violated the agency's principles of open access on the Internet. Responding to a complaint filed by Free Press and its allies in the SaveTheInternet.com coalition, Martin's move sends a strong signal to Internet service providers everywhere that violations of net neutrality will not be tolerated. Marvin Amore, general counsel of Free Press, authored the complaint against Comcast. He explains that the cable giant not only tampered with Internet traffic, but lied about doing so.
In mid-2007, there were reports from users that Comcast was interfering with their connections. Specifically, Comcast was blocking different kinds of file sharing, wasn't letting people share files with each other through BitTorrent, Nutella, and other file sharing services. Comcast denied for months, and then the Associated Press and independent testing by Rob Topolsky and Electronic Frontier Foundation proved that Comcast was lying. Comcast was actually secretly blocking consumers' ability to access file sharing protocols.
This decision is the first major test of principles outlined by the FCC 3 years ago.
In 2005, the FCC unanimously adopted a policy statement explaining how the FCC interpreted the Communications Act. And the FCC said, going forward, we're going to ensure under this policy statement that consumers have access to all lawful content online and are able to use all software applications that they want online.
Though the decision will not become official until a full commission vote on August 1st, Martin's willingness to rule against Comcast is a victory for open Internet advocates.
The chairman of the FCC announced that he would circulate an order to the rest of the commission to punish Comcast for what it did and establish baseline protections for an open Internet going forward. We're optimistic that this will be a good first step to protect consumers' access to the Internet.
Millions of people across the country have contacted the FCC and Congress expressing their concern over the future of the Internet, but there is still more to be done.
This process can go in one of two directions. The Commission could continue handling these problems on a case-by-case basis based on complaints by consumers, or we could move to a broad rulemaking at the Commission rather than complaints, or legislation from Congress.
For more information, visit SaveTheInternet.com.
The cost of text messaging is rising again. T-Mobile announced that it will join AT&T and Verizon Wireless in charging 20 cents per message. And AT&T announced that texting for new iPhone users will cost an extra $5 for 200 messages. It wasn't that long ago when many carriers offered free texting, but a 100% price hike within 2 years has some people looking more closely at the cost. A space scientist from England's University of Leicester calculated that texting is now at least 4 times more expensive than transmitting data from the Hubble Space Telescope. A blogger figured out that if the same pricing per text on a per-byte basis was applied to downloading a single 4-megabyte song, it would cost the user almost $6,000. A software developer computed that, at 15 cents per message, the markup for text messaging per kilobyte is 7,314%. There have been no further costs to the cell phone companies that would necessitate a price hike. And, in fact, the cost to carriers to transmit text messages is next to nothing. Here's why. When a cell phone is on, it is constantly connected to a cell phone tower as it waits for a call or other data. The phone and the tower send little packets of information to one another to keep in touch. These packets hold 160 characters. That's why a text message can contain only 160 characters of text, because they hitch a ride on these data packets. So compared to the costs associated with email or downloading data that need their own bandwidth, charges for texting are exorbitant. So why are cell phone companies continually hiking up prices for texting? Text messages are bringing in huge revenues to cell phone operators. Verizon reported a 33% increase in data services over last year. AT&T's wireless business profits were up 22% this year. As wireline revenue continues to decline, companies will be looking to their wireless divisions to continue their high profits. Consumers can do little to stop escalating prices. As the cell phone industry consolidates, there is less competition to keep prices in check. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, WILL AM 580. Come to you live today, July 20th, 2008. Sorry for the slight delay or confusion that came about and then going on the show today, but we're with you now and with our guest. Our guest today on Media Matters is one of the really outstanding economists of the past generation. Michael Perelman is the author of 19 books in economics, a professor of economics at California State University, Chico, and author of the brand new book, which I highly recommend, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. Michael Perelman, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, it's great to be here, Bob.
Well, this is a very powerful and, needless to say, timely book, given the current economic situation in the United States. But what I think is especially valuable about it is you do put it in a broad historical context of the past century of American history, or past half century in particular. And before we go into the nuts and bolts of the book, maybe you could explain to our listeners what you mean by the next Great Depression, and what's the basic argument of your book?
Well, the basic argument is this. Besides the fact that capitalism is unstable, when capitalism becomes unhinged, it becomes extremely unstable. And there have been three earlier periods in which we've let capitalism get unhinged. Actually, four. One would be the period of Andy Jackson. The other would be right before the Civil War. Then right before the First World War. And then finally right before the Great Depression. And each time this has happened, this unhinging had happened, in which we let loose of the moorings and let the capitalists do whatever they want, there's been an economic disaster. So here we've gone as far as perhaps any other time in the world, not the world, but the history of the U.S., and all the preconditions are there for a disaster. Whether this particular situation will be a bump in the road or whether it will be the big one, I don't know. I mean, it's just the same thing as in San Francisco. You know that there'll be an earthquake. It doesn't mean every time the ground shakes that that's the big one, but the geologists are pretty sure that that big one is on the way. So,
go ahead, Michael.
So anyway, the book was showing how we built up to this, the political movement that allowed this capitalism to become unhinged, deregulation, redistribution of wealth and income, all these things which remove any hope of balance in the economy.
Michael, in the book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, you describe the current capitalism in the United States as one of crony capitalism. And I was struck by the use of that term because in the business press, that's a very negative term, and it's usually applied to the capitalism found in East Asia or other countries, especially countries that the United States isn't especially on good terms with. And we're supposed to be living in a deregulated, competitive free marketplace. Can you explain what you mean by crony capitalism in the United States?
Well, I don't think it doesn't seem to be as clumsy as what you'd see in some tin pot dictatorship. It's more sophisticated. That is, you don't necessarily have to hand money over. It happens sometimes to politicians, but you don't have to hand money over. You can do all sorts of things. You can give a politician an enormous book contract. You can pay them to give speeches. You can hire their spouses or their children. And most of all, you give them campaign contributions. And this becomes doubly dangerous because that deflects any promise of any hope of trying to put the thing back on track. So you get no-bid contracts in return. You get all sorts of deregulatory favors. You get tax changes. And at the base, what it means is that the concerns of ordinary people go totally neglected.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Michael Perelman, professor of economics at Cal State University, Chico, author of 19 books going back to the 70s, including his brand-new book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, from Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. We're talking about that book today on Media Matters. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Perelman, the phone number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Perelman, early in the book, you have an extremely powerful chapter on the extent of inequality in the United States and how much it's grown in the past 35 or 40 years. And I've read almost everything I can find on this subject. It's an issue that I researched myself. And I must say, I thought your discussion of it was as good as any I've seen. Would you just, for the sake of listeners maybe not familiar with some of this data, just explain, give some sense of just how great inequality has grown over the past generation or two?
Well, what I did was I looked at the gross domestic product between 1970 and 2003 when I was writing the book. And it grew from $3.7 trillion to $11.7 trillion. So it almost trebled. At the same time, the population increased by 35%. So what that meant was that per capita income doubled, but not for everybody. Hourly wages peaked, and this is an incredible statistic, but if you correct for inflation, it peaked in 1972. And by 2005, it had fallen below that. That is, to go, and it still hasn't caught up with where it was in 1972. So you're talking about 35 years in which hourly wages, corrected for inflation, haven't increased. At the same time, the measure of inflation is underestimated. And it's underestimated especially for the types of things that poor people experience. Mm-hmm. So, for example, poor people are more likely to get late fees on their checking accounts, and they're likely to have to go to rent-to-own stores or check cashing services. And we don't even have to mention the predatory lending that went on for the subprime crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So then when we look at the redistribution of income, if you divide, if you think about a pyramid, and what you see is that almost all the increase in income in this 35 years came at the upper part of the pyramid, the upper 10%. Okay, now slice that pyramid off and remove that top 10%, and you have a smaller pyramid. And you see the same thing. On the smaller pyramid, almost all the increase of wealth and income came for the top 10%. And you keep doing that until you come to the wealthiest households, and that's about 13,000 families, 13,600 families. And the income share of these 13,000 families, now that's not very many families.
No, not at all.
Households, increased from about 0.5%, which is quite a lot in 1970, to 2.07% in 2004. And it's increased, I'm sure, substantially since then. So this is what's going on. Everything's coming up to these top pyramids. And the statistics don't cover a lot of what's going on at the top pyramid. That is, if you were not working at WILL, if you were running Clear Channel, is that the radio network?
My mind's
going. If you were running Clear Channel, you'd have your own private jet, and you'd probably have your own pilot to take you wherever you want. And this doesn't count in your income. This be called business expense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because you're going to meet somebody when you go in your jet to play golf. And so you write off as a business expense. And that part isn't measured in the statistics. So the statistics are much worse than they appear, the statistics are.
And one of the things that struck me as I read your book was, you know, we traditionally think of the very wealthiest people in the country being the heirs to the great fortunes, the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, who simply don't work but are worth hundreds of millions or billions of dollars and have vast incomes. But you make the point that a lot of this increase of income that's gone to this top 0.1%, where so much of it is gone, is going to salaried people now.
Well, not here's what happens. We have a for tax reasons, if you're running a hedge fund, a lot of your income isn't going to be from money. It's going to be showing up in the data as wages. So here's John Paulson, and last year he bet and won his bet, and he earned $4 billion in a single year. That shows up as wages. So when we see that average wages have gone up, you've got your wages at the University of Illinois that might have gone up 1%, 2%, and then you've got John Paulson who makes $4 billion. Mm-hmm. That affects the statistics a bit.
Mm-hmm. You know, Professor Perelman, you also talk about taxation and the tax code and what's happened to it over the past several decades. I think most people have a sense that the burden has been shifted from downward over the past four decades. That's true, but even that doesn't fully grasp what's happened, does it?
No. Part of it is with taxes, once you open up borders to globalization, then it's just absolutely easy to hide your taxes. There's a big brouhaha now about UBS, Phil Graham's bank. Mm-hmm. I hope your listeners all know who Phil Graham is, father of the subprime crisis. And what they were doing was they were hiding money for the wealthy and creating tax loopholes and tax shelters for them. You have corporations that eliminate taxes, and they do that through changing where you say that your money is. So, for example, companies like Microsoft have their intellectual property in a subdivision in Ireland, which isn't taxed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they show all sorts of profits over in Ireland, lower profits in the U.S., and their taxes magically go down. Anyone with a substantial income who can afford the lobbyists, the tax accountants, and the financial advisors has no reason at all to pay taxes at all.
Could the U.S. government collect this money if they really wanted to, if they were willing to apply the resources to do it, or is it pretty hopeless to try to collect this money from the super rich, which I think is sort of the subplot you hear whenever this issue is raised in political debate?
I'm sure you could collect some. It's so difficult now to trace money through this, although you could do it. I mean, the government has the facility, and the other countries are agreeing to be able to trace all this money. They could do it if they wanted. It would be difficult, and there would be legal complexities in order. That is, if you have an account down in the Grand Cayman Islands, and it's not even an account, it's in a corporation named for your children or something, there's some legal barriers to get to grabbing that money, but it could be done. Certainly the U.S. has enough influence to tell the Grand Cayman Islands what they have to do.
Our guest today, Media Matters, Michael Perelman, professor of economics at Cal State University, Chico, out in California, author of 19 books on economics, including his new book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, from Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Perelman, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Professor Perelman, in the book, you make a strong case for the situation we're in today with really massive inequality. Not only has grim implications for the future and suggests we may be on the verge of a major crisis, but we didn't get here by accident. We didn't get here by the workings of a free market. We're very much here because of an explicit political movement, an organized campaign to get us to this point. The right-wing extremist movement, as you call it in the book and talk about it. And I'd like to talk about, you know, how that movement came about, what it entails. But before we go there, just quickly, why do you call it right-wing rather than conservative?
Well, I think of conservative, if I were going to think about conservatives in the Congress, I would think about someone like, say, Chuck Grassley, near where you are, mm-hmm. who's conservative, but he's somebody who isn't, actually, actually, I'm at a loss for words because what the right wing is doing is so out of line that it becomes almost difficult to sum up in a single sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back to Phil Graham. That is, here's a guy who is in the Senate. You've got an 11,000-page budget resolution coming in, and he has seven law firms write up, from what I understand, I could be wrong in this, write up this legislation to deregulate futures markets. And his wife is regulator of the futures markets. And he slips this in. There's no thought. No one can read it. It's a very long, complex piece of legislation in a much longer piece of legislation. Who can go over 11,000 pages in a night? And it comes through. And it becomes extremely important in eliminating the Glass-Steagall Act, that's what I should have said before, which led to the subprime crisis. So these are people who are in a sense, mercenaries more than politicians. And I don't think there's any real conservative ideology. I mean, I can understand a traditional conservative who wants a particular type of government, but these are people who are just helping rapacious corporations and over-rich people get it richer.
In the book, Professor Perlman, you talk about the Golden Age, and that's sort of the era predating our own, the post-war era, the era of Keynesian economics being in ascension. And, you know, this era is now presented oftentimes as a Golden Age, as a glorious period that it would be great if we could return to it. Is that your assessment of that era?
Well, compared to what? I mean, look, there were many inequities and problems during the Golden Age, but a person with a high school education could go out and get a job in a mill and be able to put his kids through college. That made sense as the Golden Age. It was a period. If you think about Richard Nixon is his policies were in many ways far to the left of those of Bill Clinton. And part of it was that there was this residual of the New Deal, there was political activism, and that things were regulations and legislation was put into place that was very, very useful. At the same time, during the Golden Age, you had the Vietnam War, which helped to end the Golden Age, and you had a lot of racism and all sorts of bad things going on. There was still inequities. There were discrimination. But compared to what we have today, yeah, it was a Golden Age, unless you run a hedge fund.
Well, you you talk in the book, though, that the dark secret of the Golden Age was its reliance upon military spending to spur economic growth. Could you talk about Keynesianism and where military spending factors into that equation?
Oh, sure. What happened was, after World War II, there was a strong belief among virtually every economist that we go back into a depression, that it was military spending that got us out of the depression. You eliminate the military spending, you throw the troops back on the job market, and everything's going to fall apart. In England, in 1936, John Maynard Keynes published his General Theory. And the idea of the general theory was very vague, but American economists read it in a very clumsy way, that all you needed was more government spending to keep the economy going. But at the same time, you still had a residual of McCarthyism, and nobody wanted to be painted with the brush of socialism or communism. So to get government spending at the same time that you don't want to offend anybody, because if you spend on public transportation, you're going to offend General Motors. If you spend money for public housing, you're going to offend the landlords. But who competes with the military? So you go to military spending.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was that the political symbol of this military Keynesian would have been Henry Scoop Jackson, who turned out to be the intellectual godfather and the actual political mentor to many of the neoconservatives who got us into the problem we have.
Do you think that when the Cold War ended, or a better way to put it, the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a lot of talk about the peace dividend, how that would finally allow the United States to no longer have a wartime economy. How much of the economic role of military spending was a factor in the fact that their decline in military spending was fairly minor?
It was very minor, and you had Colin Powell going out and writing his book about his article talking about we're down to what Fidel Castro and Kim Il-sung at the time, and bemoaning that we have to find ourselves some new enemies. You had two things. Incidentally, when Eisenhower talked about this military-industrial complex, he was actually warning against the Democrats, who led by Scoop Jackson, but with Kennedy running for president, talking about the missile gap.
Mm-hmm.
So this is bipartisan nonsense going on. But the military spending is really very, very important. In fact, you even had George Bush talking about how the Iraq War is good because it's creating a lot of spending. But, of course, the Iraq War is different than the Second World War. During the Second World War, you had large numbers of workers in assembly lines building tanks and airplanes. And there are very few workers going in and building the stuff, the high-tech stuff that's going into the military spending today.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of jobs that you get from military spending is very, very small compared to what you would get if you had people building roads and fixing sewer systems.
Our guest today, Michael Perriman, professor of economics, author of the brand new book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, From Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our telephone number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Professor Perriman, you spend a good deal of the book chronicling the organized right-wing campaign to really turn this country in a direction that benefits both those atop the social structure and the military, but especially the promoting inequality. And I don't want to go through the entirety of that part of the book, but it's well worth reading. But there were a couple sections of it I'd like you to discuss, if you would, briefly. One is the role that the right wing played starting in the 60s and into the 70s through to the present day on sort of reshaping the judicial system and the legal system. Why was that important, and what has been done, and what are the effects?
Well, the effects are enormous. That is, the legal system, as you deregulate the economy, then your only hope to have any redress from corporate abuse is to have liability. And what's happened in recent years is that they have reduced the liability. It's very, very difficult to get any redress when corporations do anything wrong. You have now, if a worker is killed on the job and there's some problem, the government will fine the company less than the fine for mistreating a borough on public lands. So what it means is that the corporations are free from the one remaining barrier to them doing whatever they want.
Now, from your experience, Professor Perriman, studying this, is there a notable difference between the sort of judges that the Republicans and the Democrats are putting on the bench with regard to issues of property and corporate power?
Yes, for two reasons. One, they've spent an enormous amount of money on judicial elections. Not many people pay that much attention to elections for judges in the Supreme Court. This started in California with Rose Byrd. And they got rid of Rose Byrd and two other judges on account of the death penalty. But that wasn't why they wanted to get rid of Rose Byrd. It was because she was legislating in favor of environmental protections, or ruling in favor of environmental protections, and that just offended them. So now, throughout the country, judges, one, either get elected with this money or change the kind of rulings that they make out of fear of this money coming after them. And then to make things worse, you have organizations that pay humongous amounts of money to bring judges to fancy resorts where they can become indoctrinated in between golf rounds.
Our guest today, Michael Perriman, Confiscation of American Prosperity, his brand new book. And we are going to go to the phone lines now here on WILL AM 580. Let's go now to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Michael Perriman.
Hi. I'm really happy with your emphasis of military Keynesianism because it's just so fundamental to the economy and so many things. The Internet was funded by DARPA. You know, it's just astonishing how little pointing at it happens in culture. I actually wanted to ask about the other thing that apparently Phil Graham helped unleash, and that's all these derivative devices and all these new instruments for sort of investing. It doesn't seem like that's the right name to call it. I'm particularly wondering about if you can explain what a credit deficit swap is, if you thought that was
credit
important.
Credit default swap.
Credit default swap, CDS, because the BBC's been pointing at it and saying, and I think the EU is agitating that these sort of things ought to be collateralized in some way, too, because it's basically taking a bet on the fate of some other referent thing. A derivative implies that there's something to do with calculus, and it has to do with the rate of change, I gather. But
A derivative means that it is not an investment in something real. So if I buy a bond in your corporation, I have a real claim on your assets. But if I'm buying a derivative, I'm just betting on the value of those assets. I have no real claim to those assets. So here's what happens. Bob asked me to borrow $100, and I say, I'll lend you the money. I want 10% in return. But I'm not sure I can trust Bob. So I go to you, and I say, how much will you charge to guarantee that Bob pays back his money? And if he doesn't pay back the $100, you're supposed to pay me the $100. That's what these bets are. The problem, the reason they want it to be collateralized, is the following. If I want to bet against not Bob, but say Bob's corporation, I can make a bet by selling these derivatives. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
And so everyone who wants to bet on the fate of company X buys or sells these derivatives. And the number of derivatives can be 10, 20, 50 times the value of the underlying company. And there is no way to guarantee that these bets can be paid off if something goes bad. And that's what's happening. So it's like having an insurance company, but the insurance company doesn't have any funds.
The implication was that this could be the same kind of house of cards that the subprime phenomena is, as far as bringing down or undermining.
This is a house of cards built on a house of cards.
Hmm.
You see, because what's happening is people are betting on the fates of the banks that are betting on the subprime mortgages. And so what they're worried about is a chain reaction. As one set of institutions goes down, another set of institutions that's betting on this institution might go down.
And the implication is that there's a call for collateralization implies that there's no real regulation of these devices.
There's no real regulation.
A huge amount of money. I saw something like, I don't know, some number of trillions of dollars that are...
Yes. Many times more than the gross domestic product of the whole country for a year.
If I can interject here, Michael, in line one, because this gets ahead to the really crucial issue of financialization, which we might as well broach right now, because we are in the financial crisis. I mean, what we've seen and you discuss in the book is the huge growth of speculation and debt and these speculative instruments. How serious is this banking crisis, Michael Perriman, in your view, and what sort of range of outcomes should we expect over the next few years?
Well, I don't. Well, in economics, you can predict as pretty safely as long as you don't put a time on it. Okay, as long as I don't say it's going to happen next week or next month or next year. But the whole system, everybody's betting on everybody else. I guess the analogy would be, you're at the crap table at Las Vegas, and 10 of us can be betting on your bets, and we may or may not have the money to cover that. So the amount of derivatives, as you mentioned, is many, many, many times more than the world GDP. And if you go into a period of panic, and this is what the Federal Reserve is trying to do, it's trying to avoid panic, then people can start cashing in these derivatives and the money's not there to cover them. That's what they're afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Warren Buffett called them weapons of mass destruction.
And this seems to be the moment we're in right now. What is your sense of how successful the U.S. authorities and global authorities are in trying to address this, and how successful can they be? I mean, they don't really have a magic wand, do they, to sort of shore up all these problems?
No,
the scale is so immense.
What they have to do, that is, if you were head of the Federal Reserve today, your job would be to try to make the psychology less panicky. But the problem is that the Federal Reserve has relatively little power in many ways, much more than it would seem. It does that because it has less power because money flows back and forth from country to country. And as the dollar goes down, the prices go up, and now they're worried about inflation. And so if they lower interest rates, they can be creating more inflation. If they raise interest rates, they can set off a depression. But really what they're doing is they're playing with fire, and the fire is this whole financial system, and they really don't have adequate tools. And they may very well be able to calm it down and just have a slow, sluggish economy or maybe a recession that lasts a few years, and it may fall apart. Now, here's the problem. Usually when one of these emergencies come up, you take measures that create the next bubble. So when the stock market goes down, you lower interest rates, and then that creates a real estate bubble. Or before that, it was the dot-com bubble. And you have these series of bubbles. And with each successive bubble, you have greater and greater dangers being created.
Our guest today, Michael Perriman, author of The Confiscation of American Prosperity. You're listening to Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, you're on the air with Michael Perriman.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We can.
Yes. Good afternoon. I'm driving back up from Mattoon up to Champaign here at County, and I just caught your show and enjoyed it, so thank you.
Well, thank you.
And I've been listening to the interesting exchange. So I'm not an expert in this area, but just a couple of one comment and a couple of questions, or maybe more comments, one question. If we go back, Depression, Roosevelt brought us out, not really Hoover. Those were Roosevelt's and his brain trust ideas. People attribute something to Hoover. He really didn't do it, I think. Didn't have it. They did it by public works, funding public works, getting the pulling the people up, the people that mattered, the workers. Then we go into the World War II, and you mentioned the Golden Age, and I assume you're referring to the post-World War II, early 50s, Eisenhower years. I believe that is and was the, and probably never will be, Golden Age again, where we had so much discretionary, where the poor people, any high school graduate, could in the late 50s, early 60s, you are correct. A high school diploma, you worked hard, you could get into school, you could go to school for a couple of $1,000 a year max. So, but you did say one thing that I I wanted to clarify. Did you use the term nonsense referring to Kennedy and the missile crisis?
Did I hear the word what?
Nonsense?
Yes.
That was the closest this world ever came.
Oh, no. That's not what the nonsense
was.
That's not what I was talking about.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify.
Not the Cuban missile crisis. That happened after Kennedy is president. When he's running for president,
yes.
He talked about not a missile crisis, but a missile gap. And the idea was that the Soviets were capable of taking the U.S. out, and we were at a disadvantage relative to the Soviets.
That is correct. That is correct.
And that was what I was talking about.
And then we come into the next few later. And by the way, I agree with you on Nixon. I think he was a great president. He brought me home from Vietnam. And he opened up the world to us. But then we had the next stage, the Reagan Star Wars, money flowed, DOD. We broke the Soviet Union by money. But today, now, and here's just one of my questions. Do you agree, now, pre-World War II, Korea, and up until Vietnam, the military-industrial complex served as a support role. Never did they participate directly or replace direct functions of the deployed services. Except for the rare occurrences in World War II or pre-World War II, where we actually, all those island defenses were built by civilian contractors. Most people don't remember that today. They were built under military contracts. But we had a lot of civilian employees all over those islands. The other thing was, today, the military-industrial complex is smaller,
well, let
but
me,
higher dollar.
Let me talk about
it. Well, Michael, before you do, look, Carl, let me, if I can ask you just to wrap up right now, because we've got other people on the phone.
Yeah, just curious to see if you recognize a difference between the military-industrial support today versus 20, 30 years ago, and, you know, where do we... Oh, and also the next president will do another New Deal. I think that would be the other question. Do you believe the next president will do a New Deal to pull us out?
No.
Well, that's a great question. Thank you very much, caller. Why don't you field those sequentially, if you will, Professor Perelman?
Okay. I can start with the second question. I'm not expecting anything particularly positive from either candidate. Let me talk about the military-industrial complex.
Let me before you go on to that, let me just follow up on that comment you just made. Right now it certainly appears neither candidate's discussing the economy in ways that are anything but in the conventional wisdom. The argument on behalf of Obama goes that he would be more likely, if those mechanisms continue to fail, to be open-minded about trying something new. Now, that, I don't know if there's any evidence to base that on, but that seems to be the best case it's made for him.
He might be open to it, but he also is going to be open to pressure from the other side. And I don't see any indication that he has. He seems to have the same backbone that Clinton had as far as standing up and saying, okay, this is what I believe in. It's one thing to use lofty rhetoric, but it's another thing when you don't have the specifics to back it up. I could be wrong in that. I hope I'm wrong in that.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to have you respond to that, because that was the argument with regard to FDR, that he came to office pursuing a very mainstream Hooverian type approach to the Depression. I mean, all that failed. He shifted gears.
And he, who knows? That is, I don't know what's in the man's head.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the way his campaign has gone so far.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to talk about the military for a second.
Please do.
One of the callers called in and talked about the contribution from the Internet and the like. What's happened since then is that the type of research that the military-industrial complex is doing is not something that's going to be very useful to us. That is, they're developing methods to harden our computers so that they can survive nuclear attacks. Of all the things features I want on my computer is... not how it will survive a nuclear attack. I don't need microwaves that make people's skin burn. I don't need the types of things that they're developing. If you really wanted to get scientific progress, you give the money to the universities, but real universities, not universities that are, in effect, adjuncts to major corporations. The contracting is very interesting, and it you asked before, Bob, about right-wing and the like. And here what you have are you're taking fundamental parts of the government. As even Adam Smith said, the military is something of government. He included building of infrastructure and education and the military. He said that belongs to the government. So you're taking everything that's possibly privatized and privatizing it, and at great cost. That is, it's much more. Everybody knows about how much a soldier costs per day versus a Blackwater person. It's very, very expensive, and it's just giving no-bid contracts to buddies.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Our guest, Michael Perriman, author of The Confiscation of American Prosperity. Let's go to line one. Muhammad, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. You clearly, the subprime issue has been in the news a lot lately, and you had mentioned earlier that Phil Graham was the father of that, and I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit on the legislation and the events that sort of led up to that.
Well, it was a legislation. It was legislation to deregulate futures markets. It's often called the Enron amendment, and what it did in effect was it eliminated the ability of the regulators to look at what these bets were about. And so there's no transparency to it. And that made it possible to be selling these derivatives and selling. It was very, very important in setting off the California energy crisis. And now you're getting the Wall Street Journal is talking about energy prices soaring in Texas. So his wife was head of the board that was in charge of regulating these sorts of transactions. And then she went and got herself on the board of Enron after that.
Professor Perriman, I'd like to ask you, while we're on the subject that you've been talking about with Phil Graham and with the basic mechanisms that have allowed for the financial crisis to take place, how well do you think this has been covered in the news media and the business press? I mean, for the average citizen who consumes news media and tries to pay attention, how good of a grasp of what's going on in our political economy do they get through being through our free press system?
Well, when they start selling futures in Britney Spears, I think we'll learn more about it. But at the present time, it's not covered at all. There will be investigative stories in actually the Wall Street Journal, but the type of press that the public gets doesn't cover it at all. Economics isn't covered. There weren't any questions in the presidential debates, serious questions about the economy. And when there were questions that could be serious, they were never followed up with serious responses. It's part of the problem of what we're facing today. And this gets back, of course, to your good work about the media and the need for, I think, the two biggest changes we need if we're ever going to turn things around would be some sort of media reform along with publicly financed campaigns. As it is. Oh, one more thing.
Sure.
There's a big push today. There's a suit that looks, according to the Washington Post today, that said it might win, that will undermine the only regulation of corporate finances that came in the wake of the Enron scandals. That's the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And there's a push now to get rid of that.
Professor Perriman, what you argue in your book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity, is that, you know, this whole right-wing movement to increase inequality, to funnel money to the wealthy, to make corporations far less accountable and far more powerful, and to weaken the great bulk of the American people, that this isn't just bad for the great bulk of the American people who have lousier health care and lower quality of life and a less responsive political system, but ironically, it's also ultimately going to be very bad for these very same billionaires. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you take a company like Citibank that looked like it was a behemoth that was going to swallow up the whole world in Pac-Man style. And today it's hobbled. Now, if you would ask somebody who was invested in Citibank, say 15 years ago, would you be better off today if they hadn't had all the deregulation? If there were some sanity in the financial market, would you be better off today when your stock is way down than you would have been if there had been moderate regulation? And I think any sane person would say yes. But once the good times are coming, people want more good times. And now, part of this that we didn't get to discuss is that profits in the golden age were very, very high. And as profits started to decline, the business was trying to look for ways to increase profits. And one was deregulation, and the other was cutting back wages. Mm-hmm. And they did both very effectively. Now, profits aren't back where they were in the golden age, but they were approaching it. But they weren't profits based on efficiency and productivity. They were profits based on rapacious behavior that was, in effect, eating the seed corn. There was very, very little investment. There still is very, very little investment in productive activities. The big investment now is in things like finance and trading and retail. An economy can't go on like that.
10 years ago, no more than 10 years ago, there was, again, sort of a minor golden age with the Internet bubble and the growth of the economy during the two Clinton administrations. And it was not uncommon for people to say that the Internet and the digital communication revolution had solved all the economic problems. It would lead to a massive new flurry of investment and growth, and it would also perfect markets because information would flow so freely thanks to the Internet. What's after a decade later, that those claims look like they've got a ways to go for fruition. What's your sense of the importance of the Internet, and can these technologies slay the crisis, or the crisis overwhelm it or incorporate it?
Well, one thing the Internet can do, obviously has great potential. But because of the immediacy of the Internet, it also means that psychological behavior can become amplified. And we don't make quick decisions very well. They tend to work on panic and euphoria. So the Internet obviously has enormous potential. I would say that the telegraph had greater potential than the Internet, in the sense that the move from the telephone to the Internet is not as extreme as the move from, say, the Pony Express to the telegraph. The telegraph is useful. It was important. It helped to create radio, which helped to create the same technology, led to the same electronic type of research that gave us the Internet eventually. But I don't think it's going to come from some simple innovation. It's going to have to come from a social transformation.
And are you talking, we've only got a couple of minutes left, if that, but to force you to speak in very broad generalizations, your idea of reform, are we envisioning like a New Deal-type reform on steroids? Is that what you have in mind?
Yeah. Now, that's not going to get rid of all the problems of capitalism. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I would call it on steroids, but certainly there is a great need for infrastructure. There's a great need for public security. Look, I'm looking out my window, and I don't see any blue in the sky. And I haven't seen blue in the sky for a month. We've had fires in our town, big fires, where people are going around with masks on their face. I've been going around with masks on my face. And part of the problem was that the Forest Service and the California Division of Forestry have not been keeping up with the dangers. So, we need a much more vigorous, much stronger public arm, but we also need social reform to at least rein in the excesses of the corporate sector, and especially the financial side of the corporate sector.
Our guest today is Michael Perriman. We've only got a few seconds left before we have to close, Professor Perriman. And I just wonder if you could tell our listeners real briefly where you go to get your news about the economy, where they should go, where you suggest they look.
I browse all over. I mean, I browse in the library, I browse in journals, I browse on the Internet. There's some good sites, and there's a lot of trash on the Internet.
How about giving us one or two good sites, if you don't mind, before we close?
I'd look at Dean Baker's website. He's very good. I'd look at, I'm on a blog called Econospeak at blogspot.com. Some of the people there are very good.
On that note, unfortunately, Professor Perriman, I'm getting the signal. It's time for me to sign off. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. Our guest, Michael Perriman, author of The Confiscation of American Prosperity. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Voyle for being my producer. I'll be back 1 week from today with Senator Bernie Sanders.